I'm Sheree and I'm an addict. Let me take a deep breath because beyond my wildest dreams at my age, I didn't think I'd be up this late at night. So it's been a long day. Came back from a long business trip and hopped in the car at the airport and drove to the convention. So it's always great to be at conventions because, as the speaker said tonight, it's a time to rejuvenate, to be restored, to share some time and some experience with a lot of folks here from, you know, that I met along my journey. And my sponsor told me, she said, keep it simple. Talk about what you were like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I'm going to try to do that, and I'm going to try to do it concisely and share the time with my husband. So, wow. Beyond my wildest dreams, what I never thought that because I came from a military background, I came from a family where there were two parents who stressed education, and I had a lot of structure, so there wasn't like a whole lot of negativity going on in my family, or so I thought. My mom was real good at masking a lot of stuff. She protected me and shielded me from a lot of the abuse that was going on in my family. So, you know, what I know is my dad went to Vietnam, and when he came back, he was a different dude altogether. And I noticed that the mood in the household changed. You know, my parents were no longer holding hands, and my dad wasn't tapping her on the ass like he used to do. You know, things were a lot different. And so there used to be a lot of parties, and I would like the parties because when it was time to clean up, I could finish off the drinks at the end. And see, that's when I realized what, you know, alcohol was all about. And my mom used to always tell me, I'm going to give you just a little bit so you know what it's like, you know what it feels like, so if anybody tries to give it to you, you know, they won't take advantage of you. You know what's going on. And so, man, I used to love those parties. And that was really my first introduction to a mood-altering substance. Well, you know, when I was going through school, light skin was in, and all the dark-skinned chicks hated me, man. They used to chase me home from elementary school and pull my ponytail. And that's how I learned a lot of my manipulative skills right there, because I wanted people to accept me, to like me. And I would do anything so they wouldn't whoop my ass after school. They wouldn't chase me home. I just wanted to fit in. And because I was a very studious kid, I was an honor roll student, but I also hung out with the kids that smoked weed and did all the stuff that we really weren't supposed to be doing. And, you know, nobody believed that I did that kind of stuff because I made good grades. But I never really knew where I fit in, you know. And in high school, a lot of negative stuff happened to me, man. Beyond my wildest dreams, I would have never thought that my best friend's brother would sexually assault my sister while we were out in the park just drinking and having fun, you know. I didn't think that that's what friends were. So at that point, you know, I didn't really trust people, you know, men or women. Beyond my wildest dreams, I never thought that one of my uncles would molest me. None of that, man. You know, I thought I came from this really wholesome family. So all that shit was a shock for me. And what I know is something was missing on the inside. And so I migrated to the negative stuff. There was this really cool chick in my neighborhood. She had moved, you know, I lived in a small town in Virginia. And there was this really cool chick that moved to our town from Chicago. And, man, she taught me how to do all that stuff. So I learned really early on how to mask feelings, how to keep from dealing with that stuff. And, you know, it was just, it was a rough time. My parents divorced, and as you're growing up, you know, there are a lot of pressures to have sex and do this and do that. And I just didn't know what the hell to do or again, where I fit in. So I decided, really, my name is Sheree. Sheree was the alter ego that I created when I went to college. I decided I was going to cut my hair off, it was long, and that I was going to create this other persona, because I didn't like who I was and I wanted to be somebody else when I went away to college. And hell, who would know? None of my friends, I hadn't planned to hang with any of my friends from the town I grew up in. So, you know, I went off to college and man, I tell you, it just got worse. Not so much the escalation of my drug use, but the behavior, you know. I just acted out. I was promiscuous. You name it, I did it. I partied. I was on academic probation the first semester of school. I had actually gotten a scholarship and had been groomed throughout junior high and high school to be an engineer. And when I got to college, I informed my parents I didn't want to do that, and I lost my scholarship, much to their dismay. And I just partied, man, and had a great time. And at that time, I still didn't think there were really any negative consequences. So made it through college. I don't know how the hell I did that. Picked a major that was easy for me. I didn't have to go to class because I'm a quick learner. So made it all the way through college. And at this time, I was just really, not that this minimizes the drug, I was just smoking weed and drinking. And I didn't think that was a problem because I was functioning and doing everything I needed to do. And after I graduated from college, I met the one that worked in my building that I knew I was going to spend the rest of my life with. And started dating this guy, and I got pregnant. And the guy wanted me to have an abortion, and I wouldn't do it. And he left me, you know, just like that. And that was probably a real turning point for me in my life. Self-esteem was zero, you know, nobody wants me. Now they really don't want me because I got a kid, you know. And I went through a lot in that period in my life. I really didn't want to have any contact with him, but I ended up having to live with my father and depend on him. And now, remember, my dad was a practicing alcoholic, and the two of us together was a recipe for disaster. And it was so bad that I moved in with my father, and because we're so much alike, he moved out, left me in the house, and got another house instead of putting me out, you know. And so I was like, okay, that works for me. So I stuck around, and I got a job working at a psychiatric hospital, believe it or not. And I worked on the ward with criminally insane men. And my use had got so bad that one night the night nurse said, "What is your problem?" She was an Indian lady. "What is your problem? You get paid, you come to work, you beg, you never have money for lunch. You know, something's going on here. I think you have a drug problem." And I said, "No, I don't think so." You know, and finally she referred me to EAP. And the guy, I went in for the assessment, and me being the analytic and intellect that I am, I suited up, put the mask on, and I answered all the questions, and, you know, as I thought they should be answered. And he said, "Do you think you have a problem?" I said, "I might have a slight problem, but I don't think it's anything that, you know, is out of control. I think I can handle it." I said, "Maybe I just need a respite, you know." And he said, "No, you need inpatient treatment, and we're going to send you away to a 28-day treatment program." And I didn't go when they came to pick me up, you know. As they were talking about earlier, you should never forget your last high. And at this time, you know, I was really headed to a bottom, and I was living in a trailer out in the county. And it was summertime, man, and it was like 100 degrees outside. And I had been smoking all day, smoking, smoking, smoking. And the people from treatment came to pick me up. And, you know, I was one of those addicts, a peeper and a creeper, and real paranoid. And I was so afraid that the police were going to come. I had turned the air conditioner off. So you can imagine in a trailer, 100 degrees outside, I'm running around looking like a wild woman, no clothes on, sweating like a pig, and these people are knocking on the door trying to take me to treatment, you know. And beyond my wildest dreams, I never thought I'd be there. And I skipped a part of my story because I actually, and probably a big chunk of it, I was living in the D.C. area, and I lived in Southwest D.C., and a lot of stuff beyond my wildest dreams happened to me that I never would have thought. For instance, in my neighborhood, I would go to COP, and I would complain to the drug dealers about the package they were giving to me, and I said I could get a better deal. Now I'm trying to negotiate, get a better deal over in Southeast. So it got so bad, nobody would serve me over in Southwest, so I had to drive across the bridge to Southeast to get what I needed. And beyond my wildest dreams, I never thought I would go to COP and the drug dealer would rob me. You know, that's the kind of shit that would happen to me. And it was like, man, you know, even then God was working in my life. And I didn't even know that, you know, because it was plenty of opportunities, not just through stuff like that, but through sleeping with people without a condom. You know, just dealing with seedy characters, man, that I should be dead, truly. So anyway, got to treatment by the grace of God, and I resisted that thing. And I remember going into treatment, and you know, if that's a part of your story, when you go into treatment, how they take that initial picture of you when you get in there. And man, I'm telling you, they took that picture, and I looked like a friggin' bobblehead. My head was like this big, and my neck was about that big, and I probably weighed maybe, I don't know, 80 pounds or so, something like that. But in the background, there was the Serenity Prayer was on the wall, and the picture was dark. It just looked depressing, right? But I was smiling, and I was always kind of baffled by that. Like I went in there thinking everything was all right. I didn't really have a problem. Still in denial, you know? And that's really when there was a little chink in the armor, and there was an opening for some light to come in on the dark. And that first step kind of kicked in a little bit, like I might be a little bit powerless over this thing, you know, maybe just a little bit. And again, me being the intellect that I am in treatment, I worked through the first 8 steps, and I was, you know, the junior counselor and telling people what they needed to do. And, you know, I remember this guy used to bring the meeting to the treatment center. His name was Hardhead. And I'm sitting there, you know, a little afraid. And he comes and slams the book down in front of me, and he says, you're this particular story in the book. And I was like, I don't know who this guy is. And, you know, he started to tell me about myself. And I really started to listen because I never really heard anybody share my story. I really couldn't identify in, as they say. So anyway, I'm gonna speed my story up. So I went through treatment. That was a very humbling experience. And I got out, and I started going to another fellowship. And it was a lot of old white guys. It was real smoky, and they treated me mean, just like the speaker talked about tonight. They said, sit down, shut the fuck up. You don't have anything to share. Get some recovery, and then we'll hear from you. You know, and if you're lucky, you'll stick around. And they put me on brooms and ashtrays. And I used to come to the meeting, and I just wanted to feel better, man. I was so ashamed and so, I just did not feel good. And I really wasn't there because I wanted to stop using. I just wanted to learn how to use without the consequences. But I kept coming to those meetings, man, and those old dudes, they kept nurturing me and loving me, and it was the first time that I had a relationship with a man, and they didn't want to sleep with me, you know. And it wasn't because I didn't try. It's because they just wanted to see me recover. Beyond my wildest dreams, I never thought I would have men in my life that were really concerned about my well-being, not my body. And you know, I stuck around for a while, and I was able to admit that I was powerless over my disease and that my life had really become unmanageable. It was, I was not in a good place. And luckily, I had a sponsor. She was a real I guess people would call her an NA Nazi even. You know, she was real big on steps. And, you know, what I know about my disease is when I came in, even though I stopped using, those behaviors were, like, rampant still. And she used to come in. I would leave the meeting and, of course, be outside with some dude, you know, doing whatever I was doing. And she would come out there and pull me in the meeting and just be so rough with me, you know. And now I know that it was because she loved me. And, man, I tell you what, I started to develop a relationship with a woman that I never had before. You know, beyond my wildest dreams, there was a woman in my life that I could trust, that I could tell anything to. And she was my sponsor for a long time. And I stuck around and was able to understand that I could be restored to some sanity. And, you know, what I understood about the word restored was that I had some. So I definitely could get back to that, but there was some work that needed to be done. And I was definitely insane and subject to go back to that at any given moment. You know, one thing about having some time, you know, sometimes people in our lives or in my life put expectations on me. Just because I say I have a certain amount of time, they think, you know, I should be behaving a certain way. But what I know is my disease has become even more cunning, even more baffling the longer I have stayed around here. And, man, it will come up in the most obscure ways, you know, when I least expect it. I had this pattern since I've been coming around. What I do is, like, every 5 or 6 years, I get tired of going to meetings, man. And my disease tells me I don't have to do service, that I don't have to go to meetings on a regular basis, even though I know it says meeting makers make it, you know. And that's what I learned early on. When I first came around, my sponsor got me involved in service. I never thought beyond my wildest dreams that I could be of service to anyone because I was a taker. I was always a taker. It was always about me, self-centeredness. And through coming to the fellowship and allowing people to love me and me loving some people, I got some different habits and learned some different tools, things that I had never done before. As far as the third step, I always had a concept of a God who was punishing. That's what I was taught, that if you sin, you were going to hell. And that you needed to go to church to be saved and prayed over and this and that. And my concept was all jacked up. So I had a little bit of difficulty with this step, you know. And as I stuck around, I got a different understanding. They told me that my God just had to be loving and caring. And I liked that. I liked that. Because truly, all I wanted to be was accepted unconditionally. Just me, myself, the way I am, and the way that I was. And, you know, I stayed on this particular step for a really long time because, and I still suffer from this defect today. I am rebellious. I go with claw marks. I don't surrender easily, even though one of the things that people told me when I first came around was there's victory in surrender. And all I had to do was surrender to a loving and caring God or to a power greater than myself, you know, and I understood that to be the group, the literature, another addict, my sponsor, you know, any of those things could work for me if I chose to use them. And so I did. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. And when I got to the fourth step, because I had gotten a really good foundation with 1, 2, 3, had been involved in a lot of service work, I didn't have any fear going into the fourth step because I really wanted to know who I was, what caused me to tick the way I do. So I did a fearless and moral and a thorough inventory, or so I thought. It was easy to write about the negative shit about myself, that, you know, I had done all these horrible things. And not even necessarily to other people, you know, other than you know, I wasn't that addict who stole from people, and that doesn't make me any different. I just was a functional addict. I worked, got a paycheck, I used, and was still able to do some other things, and that's probably what delayed me, you know, even getting help to begin with, because I didn't think I had a problem. But when I did my fourth step, I found it really interesting that I had such a hard time writing the good stuff about myself. And there were a few things, not many, but there were a few that I could identify at least. And when I got to that question in the guide, I had such a problem with that. And my sponsor was asking me, well, I know you've been making good progress on your fourth step. What's the holdup? And so I had to talk about how difficult it was for me to talk about any good characteristics that I had, because for so long people had told me I wasn't shit, or at least not my family, but the people in my peer group who for whatever reason might have had some issues around jealousy, because I really like didn't fit in the group per se. So when I did my fifth step, that probably has got to be one of the most powerful experiences that I had. My sponsor took me out to a lake, and we sat by the water, and we did that fifth step. And, man, she held me. We cried. And she talked about some of the things she had done. And I left out of there feeling like I wasn't the worst person in the world, you know, that I could change if I wanted to through working the steps of this program. Beyond my wildest dreams, I never thought that I could experience just a little bit of freedom and not be the tortured soul that I was up until this point. So I continued on with the steps in 6 and 7. Whew, that was a rough patch for me. 6 and 7 is always hard for me because, I just hate dealing with my defects. And that's part of the whole problem right there. It tells you in 7, you know, humbly ask, and they can be removed if you choose to allow God to remove them. Because I still struggle with issues of control and thinking that in and of myself, I can remove them. And I struggle with that shit. And then eventually I realize, hey. And one of my biggest struggles is you know, I always had that Cinderella syndrome that I would meet my knight in shining armor, and that he would carry me off on his white horse, and we would live in the castle I keep hearing everybody share about. I had a castle or the hut. You know, we would have the kids, and I'd have this wonderful life, but none of that shit happened. Dudes always left me. You know, it didn't matter if I slept with them on the first night, if they were one night stand or long-term relationship, the message I always got because they left me was that it didn't really matter what I did. They were going to leave me any damn way. The message I got from the women in my life is that you do anything to keep a man. Those are the only models that I had about relationships. So relationships, as they say, is a very tricky area. And for me, it was. And it caused me a lot of pain, man, because I kept trying to fill that void through sleeping with people. And the area that I was in, nobody was talking about that openly, you know. And people were telling me, oh, you shouldn't be sharing that in an open meeting. You need to share that with your sponsor. But what I know about my process is I get freedom from talking about that shit in a meeting, because guess what? Somebody else needs to identify with that. And I was talking about how I was, you know, rolling this dude in and not protecting myself, man. You know, and it's only by the grace of God that I didn't contract anything life-threatening. But I caught some shit now. Don't get it twisted. I did get some stuff along the way, unfortunately. And what I recognize is I did not only have problems in intimate and romantic relationships, I had problems in relationships. I didn't know how to have any kind of relationship. So my sponsor had me to go back and do a four-step solely on relationships with my coworkers, with, you know, girlfriends, men, whoever. And, man, that had to be one of the most revealing and freeing things about the fucked up patterns and belief system that I had about relationships, and that I was still using the old manipulative tools that I always used because I wanted you to love me, man. I was desperate for love. And as recent as, hell, 10 years clean, man, I'm telling you what, I was on so many damn date sites because I wanted to meet my husband, because I wanted somebody to love me unconditionally. And I was spending lots of money on those sites, man. And the pressure of being an older woman, I'm nearing 50, never been married, all my girlfriends getting married, I obsessed over that shit so much. And one of my girlfriends says, surrender, just surrender. You trusted God on everything else in your life, you got the evidence. You know, because I'm a burning bush person. I got to see that shit before I believe it. So I was like, okay, God, man, I cried out to you before to get me clean. In my wildest dreams, I never thought I'd be clean a day at a time in spite of all the shit that has happened to me. And I'm so, so, so grateful. I couldn't put a better plan together. God put a master plan together that turn me into the person that I am today, and I'm so grateful that I'm spiritually positioned to be used by him. And man, I said, okay, I'm gonna try this thing. I shut down probably about 20 date sites, and I saved myself probably about $200 a month, you know, in the process. And you know, my higher power knows I'm an impatience is another one of my defects. I want it right now, right now. And 2 weeks later, my girlfriend said, well, you know, we're going to the NA cookout, and why don't you come? And I was like, hell no. I'm content. I got all the blinds drawn. I'm depressed. I'm in here. I ain't getting none. I ain't going on no dates. I ain't doing nothing but reading literature. And I'm like, okay. Which, quite honestly, wasn't satisfying. So she said, please, just come out. You know, you need to fellowship. Don't isolate. So I went to this NA cookout, and I knew it was a setup. She said, I got somebody I want you to meet. I was like, oh, hell no. We're not going down that road. And she said, just meet him. You know, he's got a good program. And it was almost like she was marketing this dude, right? So I was like, okay, I'll meet him. And she introduced me to this guy right here. And I was like, damn, he's tall. But he's not really my type. You know, quiet. Because I'm very outspoken, very opinionated. You're going to hear what I have to say. I cut to the chase, brutal honesty. And I'm learning how to work on that. Finesse it so it's not so rough going in. And he's the total opposite, man. He's real humble, quiet guy. And I was like, I don't think so. So he says, can I take you to lunch? And I was like, yeah, my girlfriend can come along. And he was like, you need a chaperone? I said, yeah, because I don't trust myself. Even though I don't think I like this dude, I might sleep with this guy, right? I don't want to. So don't want to have him have a bad impression of me. And needless to say, here it is a little bit later, and we're married, you know. And I didn't pick this guy, man. I ain't picked this guy. In fact, I thought he was so nice I'd run over him. But he showed me that that was not going to be the case. And I'm extremely happy. And what has happened as a result, because I really want to be a better person, a good wife, for the first time I became friends with the person first. And and I received a lot of other blessings, you know, and I don't want to tell his story, but in the process I got to meet his mother, who was, you know, terminally ill. And I was able to develop a relationship with her that was beyond my wildest dreams. You know, when I first met this lady, I was so nervous. I thought, oh, God, you know how mothers are when you meet the moms of the guys that you date, and they grill you, and I was so concerned. I had one of my toes didn't have nail polish on it, and I was going to meet her, and I was so obsessing over the fact that one of my toes didn't have a polish on it, and I was like, oh, my God, she's going to see it. So I'm sitting trying to cover up my toe, you know, trying to make this impression, and I just prayed, and it came to me, just be yourself, you know, and come to find out, we were just alike, and this woman was so amazing. Beyond my wildest dreams, I was able to develop a relationship with my own mother that I never had. You know, when I was probably 9 years clean, I was able to share with my mother that her brother had molested me. And as a result of me being honest, she talked about her own molestation. And from that point forward, man, we have developed such an awesome relationship. I talk to my mother about everything. I mean, she's 73. We talk about sex. She likes to gamble and go to Vegas and travel. And our relationship is just awesome, you know. And as far as my father is concerned, I've had an opportunity to tell him, you know, how I felt about him. And our relationship is great. Beyond my wildest dreams, I would have never had the opportunity to do many of the things that I've done. And it is only because of this program of Narcotics Anonymous, you know, that I've been able to go back to school, get a few degrees, have a great job, even though in my mind I assassinate my boss over and over and over and over again. I had to work on that. But this program, they told me when I came in to write down, and I still have it today in my very first journal that I ever got, what I expected to get out of this program. And it has been so much more. And probably the greatest thing that I've gotten is the ability to be comfortable in my own skin and not be concerned so much about what you think about me. That was such a long time coming for me. And you know, it's through the broader the base, the higher the freedom. Man, I've traveled around to a lot of places, got a huge network, you know. And anywhere I go, man, I feel loved just as I am with all my flaws, all my assets. And that's just a beautiful thing that so many different people can come together in a place and be able to have that kind of bond, that kind of connection, you know. And I'm so grateful that my higher power selected me to find this program to improve my spiritual fitness, man, so I could be of use to somebody. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Cherie. I'd like to introduce our second speaker, Phil from Frederick.
Addict named Phil.
Hi, Phil.
I'd like to thank the program committee of this convention. should have went the other way. My higher power first, program committee, and the Frederick region for selecting me to speak tonight. Beyond your wildest dreams. First of all, I shouldn't be up here. I should have been at one of the other workshops. I'm going to just tell on myself. That's what my sponsor said, tell the truth, and let the chips fall where they may. I was asked by one of my home group members to speak on a topic that I didn't have a lot of experience on, but had I looked in the book, I could have found some information and read about it, and maybe I could have given my experience, strength, and hope on it. What did I do? I'm manipulative. I'm an addict. That's my little play. And I said, I can't do it, but I know somebody who'd be perfect for that. And I said, my sponsor will do it. And my home group member called my sponsor, did it. Well, so happened. They need somebody to do Beyond Your Wildest Dreams. And I don't need a whole lot of time to think, because when I do, I get up in here, and this committee up here, they some wild, crazy dudes. I mean, them motherfuckers, excuse me, I curse a lot when I'm sharing, because Sometimes motherfucker is just a motherfucker. That's you know, right. MF, you can't, there's no other adjective or adverb or whatever it is to describe it. So these motherfuckers up here, they out of control, okay? And without this program, I'd be dead. So I manipulated my way to get my sponsor or someone else to put, you know, get them to do a workshop. And what, I only had a few days, not even a day, but a few hours to think about it. They said, oh, we need you to step in for somebody else. And I'm just saying, that's my higher power saying, you need to do this. And when people ask you to share, you need to give your experience, strength, and hope. And that's what I want to do. Beyond my wildest dreams, unbelievable what's going on these last 11 years of my life, being in this program. Incredible. I am truly grateful. I always say I'm a grateful recovering addict, but humility is a big thing there, and I'm just going to go with my story, and you're going to hear that for a long period of my life, I was not grateful for what I had, and that's where I am at. Started beginning. There's so many people I've heard speak today, and including my wife, that we have so many things in common, and what I'm hearing is a common trend. A lot of us have grown up in very strict militaristic households. My father was in the military also for 30 years. And in that household, everything went according to plan. You wake up in the morning, you go to the bathroom, you take a shower, you make the bed, you know, you go to school, you do your role, you have your part. You have a part to play in here. And my mom and dad, normal people. Okay, they ain't like me and you. They could have a glass of champagne at New Year's and don't have another one till the following New Year's. Not me. I'm looking at them like, why don't you drink the whole fucking bottle? You know, that don't make no sense. You open it and waste it. Come on. But that's just my addict thinking. But growing up in this household, you did things their way. And, you know, jumping around in my story, Sheree is much like my mother. I understand that I don't want a sexual relationship with my mother, but I need somebody to keep me in check sometime. And she's very honest, much like her. That's why they get along, and I love them both. But, you know, early on in my life, moving quite a bit. We lived in Germany, France, all up and down the East Coast. We moved every 2 or 3 years. This allowed me a chance to make friends, and also allow me a chance. If I didn't make friends or didn't get along, fuck you. And we moved on. We moved. So, and our parents, they enabled us. My brother, I'm the oldest, and my brother's 4 years younger than me. And we had opportunities to move and things like that. And our parents, I don't want to say bribed us. Yeah, they did. They bribed us. They said, look, you're moving. And I was manipulative at a young age. And I'd say, I'm moving. I'm leaving all my friends. What you going to do? They'll buy us a bike. They'll take us on a trip. They will give us things. And that was just my pattern. And I was like, yeah, I'm getting away with shit. That was my first drug, fantasy. My wife was on vacation. And she said, what you doing? I said, I'm watching TV. I'm watching the Cartoon Network. I'm watching the Herculoids. I love cartoons, and I'm the little boy who liked to be the hero, and I like to come into the sunset, and you ride off on the sunset with that little girl on your lap on the horse. I'm John Wayne, and that shit gets my dick hard. Okay, I want to be a hero and save people, so I like fantasy. Okay, and I like to save people and moving my story ahead. Lost my point after going that far into the cartoons. I'm thinking about that now. But I just enjoyed the manipulation. And my parents, we moved a lot, and they manipulated us. We manipulated them, and we'd have these parties. My dad was an officer, and I'm the little black guy. And in those days, early 60s, 70s, there weren't a lot of black officers in the bases we were stationed at. And I was the little black guy. I was the nice guy. My little brother was the angry little fat guy. So everybody said, oh, Phil, you're so nice. You're a nice young man. And I'm looking at him like, you just don't know. But they would have these parties at my mom and dad's house. And I said, my mom and dad didn't drink. They were social drinkers. You know, didn't bother them. But these people would have these parties. And to this very day, I'm still amazed that these drinks with an umbrella in them and all this fruit and all this other stuff. It's intriguing. I still look at that stuff. I'm like, damn. So as this little boy, I did what she did. I used to sneak drinks. I'm going to sneak some drinks. You know, I'll sip a drink here, drink that. Someone has a cigarette there. I would hit it. And I don't think I understood what I was doing, but I enjoyed what I was getting. And what I was getting was I was getting away with something. I thought that it was some kind of gratification that I deserve this. I'm going to be a good little boy, but y'all deserve to let me do this. So, you know, early on, I was quite manipulative. Throughout high school, my use wasn't, I could, maybe I drank two or three cans of beer. You know, I drank some Wild Irish Rose, you know, with the boys, you know, everybody put in a quarter, drink a thing of Wild Irish Rose with 12 people. How many sips is that? But hey, I wanted to be a part of something, you know, but the real thing, I love my Uncle George, and his disease killed him, and I watched it kill him, but I was in my active addiction, and I didn't realize, you know, what this disease can do to us. And he was the first person who gave me a sip of beer, and he drank Pabst Blue Ribbon. Well, I call it Panther Piss, okay? And he gave me a sip of that, and once again, I thought I was getting away with something. And every time I'd go to his house, he would, come here, Phil, have a little sip of beer. You know, so every time Uncle George came over, I got a little buzz. But all through high school, I haven't talked about girls ever. No, because I was a late bloomer. And I associate this with, in my household, I don't know, my brother and I don't know how we got here. Because we never saw our mother and father kiss. They never showed any affection to one another. We go to the bedroom door and listen, and ain't hear nothing. On TV, they doing something, but what's going on here? We just didn't, and my brother, we're the same way. We're very, she'll say it, I'm very strict and regimented and just boring, you know, in that aspect. Am I? I don't know. But we just didn't see that. We just didn't see that. And moving my story forward, I think that's something that I need to work on. But through high school, I grew. We moved from Germany in 75, and I was 5'11" and in the ninth grade. By my senior year, I was 6'5". And my clothes was the same size as they were when I was 5'11". It wasn't that my mother, we didn't have money or things like that. She was just, you know, she was like, you'll grow into them or we'll wait. Or we lived in North Carolina. It was pretty warm. So, you know, they up here like that. You know, it wasn't no big deal, you know. And I looked like, anybody watch that show called What's Happening? I look just like Raj with the little afro and the glasses, you know what I'm saying? That's why I had no girlfriend, you know, looking like that. But so you can see the self-esteem there, you know. I'm growing into my body and becoming a young man and not feeling a part of, moving quite a bit, you know. So I'm building up this, I don't know. That's how I'm feeling. That's how I'm feeling. So it's time to go to college. And I played 1 year of high school basketball. People say, oh, you're so tall. But, you know, being tall don't mean nothing if you can't use it to your ability. So I pride myself with working hard. But my high school coach, I played 1 year of high school basketball, 1 year. And didn't have any scholarship offers. Nothing came through. And I went to a small college in Durham, North Carolina, North Carolina Central University. And that first year, I didn't participate in basketball. I didn't. That was the first time I didn't play sports. But I participated in something else. And sitting on that bed first week of school, looking at my roommate, and he passed me a joint. And I was like, I don't really feel like going to class, Greg. And Greg said, well, what's stopping you? I said, and I almost said it. And he just looked at me and said, you don't have to. You don't have to. You don't have to do. It's your choice. You can do whatever you want to do. But I was about to say, my mother would not want me not to go to class. So for 2 years, the next year I made the basketball team, and it's all MAC. I was pretty good, but I didn't go to class. I saw that I could manipulate my way. I said, okay, they want me to play this sport. I'm pretty good. They're going to give me a scholarship. They gave me a scholarship. I played on the team. I went to as little class as I had to, and I partied from 1978 till 1999. I partied hard. And the places that they took me was three different universities. I did graduate, but three different universities because, you know, beyond my wildest dreams, I'm sitting in a school in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And after you transfer from a Division I school, you have to sit out a year. So I'm trying to get my grades together and play with the team, and I'm a decent player, but unmanageability creeps in pretty quickly in my use. And active addiction. And I come to one of the games, and I'm a redshirt player. I have to sit behind the bench. I come to one of the games, and I can't remember what I had, but it was a fifth of some kind of liquor. And I'm sitting behind the bench, passing it back and forth with some of the people in the stands. The coach turns around and said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm drinking. What's the problem?" He said, "See me tomorrow at my office." I see him the next day, and he's like, "You need to tell your daddy to come pick your ass up." I said, "For what?" He said, "Because you drinking at the game. Phil, you was drunk." I was like, "I wasn't drunk. I was just drinking." He was like, "But you don't get it." I was like, "No, I don't. You know, I'm 6'7". By this time, I've grown about 205, 205 pounds. I think I'm a pretty good player. And I'm like, "Do you know what you're doing?" He's like, "Yeah, I'm sending your dumb ass home." So consequences are pretty early in my, you know, active addiction. And but, hey, beyond my wildest dreams, things just happen for me. I go home, and my dad's pretty pissed off about it. And he says, "You going to join the Army or you going to go back to school?" That was easy for me because I'm a punk. So I'm going to go back to school. And once again, I'm like that cat with nine lives. I land on my feet, and I get another opportunity to go to school in Oklahoma, and I graduate. I play there. I'm all District 9. And don't you know, I put it down for a minute. I slowed my use down. I think I did. Probably not. But I didn't get in too much more trouble. In fact, I did get arrested. I'm sorry. I'll tell the truth. I got arrested. And that was just for disorderly conduct. Okay? Because the cop said, "Anybody else want to go to jail today?" I said, "Man, you can't talk to us like that. Get your dumb ass in that cop car." You know. So that's the kind of stuff I do. You know, I'm not going to hold nobody up. I'm not going to rob nobody. I talk a big game, but, you know, I'm small inside. So beyond my wildest dreams, I've just been given so many opportunities, and I just squander them. You know, I just keep on. And I expect it to. I'm Phil. I'm supposed to get these opportunities. You're supposed to look out for me. But really deep down inside, the higher power that I have today, or that I believe in today, is a loving, caring higher power. But the one I believed in when all those things was happening was this old gray guy with a gray beard sitting on a throne throwing shit at Phil. You know, "Okay, Phil, you got in trouble here. Here, take that." And he's it's a tsunami. We have a tsunami. We have an earthquake. You know, that's the kind of God I believed in, you know, and that's why I say beyond my wildest dreams, my first thing is, my God, I have a God. I have a God that cares and loves me and looks out for me and was walking with me through all that other stuff. So moving my story forward, I graduate from college, nothing really to do, and once again, higher power, whoever helps me out, and I get an opportunity to play basketball in Europe. And I do that for 6.5 years. But I know everywhere I went, people say, "Damn, that dude could play." But in the same breath, he could drink too. And anything else you put out there, I did it. Because I feel that I deserved it. I felt that I had to do it. You know, Lay's potato chips, you can't just have just one. And that's me. And I have a reputation to uphold. okay? I'm going to drink the bar dry and get up the next day. It's something that was said about an NBA player, and they said the same thing about me. They said he is a basketball playing, womanizing, drug-using motherfucker. And that's what I did. Everything I did in that life, I did it to my fullest. And I thought that was the, I thought that was my dream. I thought I was supposed to have a vehicle, a beautiful car, home, wife, all these other things, and not have to work for it, or I would just go out like that. And in this journey I had, you know, playing basketball, I really wasn't happy. I wasn't happy. And there was something I was looking for. That's why I was using. I really had to look at myself and say, why am I doing this? Well, we always look for a cure, and only hams are cured. So I look for this cure, and the cure was I'll stop playing basketball because I see this lifestyle is leading me where it's leading me. I'll get married. So in 1992, I stopped playing basketball. I'm still a young guy, but I stopped because this lifestyle is killing me, and I'll get married and it'll change. Well, I stayed in that relationship for 13 years and didn't stop me. I think I stopped for 2 weeks. And that relationship just deteriorated. We grew apart, you know, why not, you know? That's something I still have some resentments about. But I have to work on that. But beyond my wildest dreams, in that relationship, there was something that happened. And I came home one evening, and I was, as some people say, shit-faced. I was done. And sitting on the sofa, I just wanted to be left alone. And my wife, my ex-wife, called my mother and father, and they came over. And if anybody has seen that show, Intervention, anybody seen that? I did the first episode, okay, back then. And that shit ain't funny when somebody's calling your shit to the carpet, you know? That don't feel good. And like she said, a chink in her armor, there was a chink in mine. And I just told them what I was doing. They knew mostly. But I just said it. I said, I've been doing this, and that's why no money is here, and that's why we don't have any savings, and that's why every time you ask us to go somewhere, she don't want to go because she don't want to be with my drunk ass. And you know, I just threw it all out there. And that was the beginning of this journey I've been on. That was the beginning when I said, damn, I knew I had a problem, but I went into treatment because I said, I just want to gain some weight, get my weight back. I was about down to 170 pounds. I want to get my weight back. I want people to trust me again and try to control this, control use. That's all I wanted. So my dad gave me some options. He said, you can go to treatment or I'm going to go to your job. At this time, I was working with a youth organization, still am, and I'm going to go to your job. And they, you know, once they find out you're doing this, you can't work with them kids anymore. And that, I said, oh. And the only reason I said I would do it because that was my income, you know? So I said, after I get myself together, I'm gonna save some money, and I'm going to really party then. So didn't work out like that. Went to treatment, kicking and screaming. And my counselor, they took that picture of me also. You know, I looked horrible. And he said, Phil, first interview, he said, you Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. During the week, you're a law-abiding citizen, a great husband and all that. But as soon as the clock ticks Friday to Sunday, you off the chart. And that was me. I didn't care. And that's what I deserved this. You know, I need proof. And before I got into treatment, I just, you know, I didn't think anything would work for me, you know? But I had to have some belief in something. And just like that 40 ounce of Old English, this program, it works. because that drink work, you know, and I have to see it. I have to see people like you work this program. I have to see people who have come from far worse backgrounds and worse situations than me and see them walk out of that stuff and work it. Every time I hear somebody speak, every time I see somebody, you know, disabled, and I say, you know, I was at a meeting and a guy was blind. I was like, damn, but he's alive, you know? And I'm like, this program is awesome. But I still had some time to go. So I went to treatment, and I just enjoyed hearing some of the things they were saying, and I was kind of understanding about this is a disease of addiction, and there was young ladies there. You know, I like that. I like being with them and talking with them and manipulating all that old shit. And but finally someone said, Phil, you got to get serious. So, talk about today. I'm sorry. Beyond your wildest dreams. I got to keep reminding myself. Through this program, I was able to man up, stand up, and in the relationship I was in, walk away from it. My then sponsor told me, if you stay in that relationship, you will use again. Because you got using addicts in that house, you got a manipulative situation going on, you need to get out of there. So I walked through that with the help of addicts, and I worked through it and got a divorce. And not understanding that that later I would meet a young lady who really cares about me. So beyond my wildest dreams, for a long time, I had a sponsor who was crazy, who didn't know anything about the steps, and just a fucked up dude, but was clean. It was me. Because in between having a sponsor, I had no sponsor for a long period of time, and now I have a great sponsor. And in this last year, he showed me something, and this is something that just goes beyond anything I could ever imagine. I talk about my mom all the time, and if she's my heart, and she passed away on December 29th. I watched her for 2 years develop or have this disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS, and it totally immobilizes your whole body. But your mind is still sharp. So I'd go visit her from day to day. And the part about my sponsor, I'm sorry. He encouraged me to visit my mom and build our relationship. It was always good. You know, she enabled me, but it was always good. So my sponsor told me, this time is here for you to visit your mother and work with her and see how she's doing. Well, his mother was ill also. And he said, we all get older, we're not going to live forever. So I watched him work with his mother, and November 7th, I married this beautiful woman. 2 weeks later, my sponsor's mother died. 4 weeks later, my mother passed away. I don't believe God is up there throwing stuff at me anymore, but through this program, through working with a sponsor, he's making me work the steps. I'm kicking and screaming. I don't want to, but it's going to help me. Through that process, I was able to watch my mother go to hospice, and I watched her breathe her last breath. They took the apparatus off, and she looked at all of us and said, I love you, and take care of your father. Beyond my wildest dreams, I'm a runner. I check on my dad. She gets upset with me because he's going to be all right, you know. My dad goes to the gym more than me every week, you know. He's 77 years old, but he lost somebody we lost somebody he was married to for 50 years. I've known her all my life. And things just are going to be a little different. But had it not been for this program and people in this program who I learned from and watched them go through this horrible, this is just life stuff, life on life's terms. That stuff happens. But as my wife says, I think everything happened to me is a catastrophe, you know? And I'm blaming people. I'm a blame thrower. So this program has helped me realize that this is just life. And you're going to have to get through it. And you have a network. You have all this literature that we use at your disposal. And I'll say this, for so many years, I've been in, you know, just clean and not doing anything. What kind of person goes to a 12-step program and don't work the 12 steps? God damn, how stupid can you be, you know? And that's what I keep telling myself, so I continue push forward so I can have some peace, you know? And I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me, but I used to play that. Now I'm feeling better about myself, you know? And this program has allowed me to, you know, to do that for myself. But today, my wildest dreams, you know, I know it's material stuff, but I bought a house with my wife. We were married. We went on a cruise. I don't think those things happen. It is life on life's terms. But I also know there was preparation, and I had to be prepared and had to do some footwork to have those things, okay? And it's all because of this program. How could I be an active addiction, have any of that stuff? I lost all that stuff, you know? I lost a career, you know? And I got to be honest with myself. I had dreams back then, and that was playing in the NBA, but my drug use and my addiction took that from me, you know? And I'm just here to say to all the newcomers, everybody, this program works. It is proof here, even though, you know, my knuckles ain't white, but I white knuckle it a lot, you know? That shit ain't good. Now, you don't have to, bro. You don't have to. You don't have to do that, you know? This program is easy. It is very easy. I make it difficult. I am a blame thrower, and I try to blame people for my home group member. He wanted me to do some H&I with him, and I was like, now, you're going to have to call me a week in advance. He said, I would never last minute you. You know what I'm saying? I said, because if you call me less than a week in advance, I'm going to be mad with your ass. That's going to free me, okay? And 2 weeks, 2 days after we buried my mother, my sponsor had me up at Jessup Penitentiary bringing a meeting in there. And he said, this is for you. This is for you. You think you're doing it for them. This is for you. And them brothers embraced me. And I got that, you know, that mentality, the homophobia and that prison, you know, shit. So I was really paranoid about that. And them guys were like, man, Phil, we men. You know, this is, you know, thank you for the meeting. You know, and we talk. You know, when the guys get out and they call me, I'm like, what you calling me for? Because you got something we want, motherfucker. You got something we want. I was like, what do I have to offer you? You know, that's my sponsorship brother there, Byron. I love him, man. I didn't have a big brother, okay? And this program has enabled me to have many brothers, sisters, another mother. You know, I have a mother-in-law and a father-in-law, and her father's ill, you know? Without this program, I wouldn't care about him or anybody else, just me. I can say, I love that man. I love Greg. Wake up, Greg. I love Greg. You know what I'm saying? We have sponsorship meetings, and we talk about a lot of different things. Oh, my God, we talk about a lot of stuff. And I just didn't have that opportunity. Or when we on the street, y'all, come on. How many people you cop and you like, do you think I really should do this? This could be harmful to my health. You think that dude dealing that, hustling that, trying to get that with you, what's he going to say? Well, motherfucker, you paying for it anyway, regardless. You know? I followed hustlers down the alley to their stash, and they turn around with a gun. I'm like, dude, kill me. I'm dead anyway. Fuck it. You know? Okay, thank you. So what this program has enabled me to be is human. Okay? I was living like an animal. Now, a lot of people have a different story when they say they were living in their car and they were homeless and all that other stuff. We all hit our own bottom. But the thing that had me, I couldn't look in the mirror. I'm 6'8", but I felt 2'8". I couldn't look in the mirror. And this is the enjoyable part. I work with young people. And never in my wildest dreams did I think that one day I would be the director of a whole region of youth development programs. And when I started, I wasn't doing it for that. These children, your children, they call me Mister. They don't say motherfucker. They don't say that's a lousy bitch there. They don't say that. They say Mister. And I'm like, I say, pull your pants up. You know, we do a lot of non-verbal stuff with them. I look at them like, stand up. Okay, pull your pants up, take your hat off, you know. And they respond. Had they seen me in that other lifestyle? I don't know. Would I get that same respect? And that is payment enough. My wife and I go back and forth. I say, it ain't about the money, you know. But, you know, we need money to survive. But really, I'm getting paid every day by those children, and it is more gratifying than any of the money I made when I played overseas. It is more exciting every day. They keep me young. You know, I was talking to a guy coming up, and he was like, you going to play in the tournaments tomorrow? I said, no, why? I play with high schoolers every Tuesday and Thursday. They allow me to play with them, you know? And they say, you know what? You're all right, Mr. Phil. You're all right, dude. That pays me right there. And I have to continue doing what I'm doing with Narcotics Anonymous and this fellowship and doing what I need to do, because one day one of those children or someone in their family may need NA. It's attraction rather than promotion. I don't walk around with it and all say that, but if they come through those doors, at least we should have the meeting open and ready to receive them if they need this one day. Or somebody in their family. And that's how I look at it. Once again, I'd like to thank the program committee for allowing me to speak. I'm sorry I bounced around a little bit, but you know, I'll have a little bit of humor with my message of my experience, strength, and hope. But I hope somebody got something from this. And this is a wonderful, wonderful conference. I love coming here to this convention. And beyond my wildest dreams, that would I ever think I'd be up here speaking to this great group of people. I want to thank you all again, and I'll keep coming back.